Thanks for pressing play. You're listening to Lockhead on Marketing, the podcast for entrepreneurs, marketing executives, and category designers with a different mind. I'm producer Jason DeFilippo, and all of us here are glad you're here. On this episode, we welcome back Chris's brother from Down Under, Al Ramadan. Al is the CEO of Play Bigger Advisors, which he co-founded with Chris, and of course, he's a co-author of Play Bigger the Book. Al recently presented at the Super Ding Dong Monterey Summit for Tech Investors. Chris and Al dig into what is a category contender and what it takes to win the 18 to 36 month epic category battle that every tech startup faces. So, if you're an entrepreneur or marketing leader who wants to go beyond competing to actually create and dominate your own market, you're in the right place. Set sail with the Category Pirates newsletter today. Category Pirates is one of the most read paid business newsletters on Substack, where the art of category design is the compass guiding you through the uncharted waters of market innovation. Plunge into the briny depths of creating and dominating new markets, learning from the legendary captains of category design themselves. Hoist your sails and chart a course to undiscovered success. Subscribe today and master the seas of opportunity. Category Pirates is like Harvard Business Review, but for pirates. Now weigh anchor at categorypirates.com and join the crew today. Now, hey ho, let's go.
This is Lockhead on Marketing, the podcast that helps you develop the lens for what makes legendary marketing legendary. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, three-time CMO, godfather of category design, and a high school dropout, who the Marketing Journal calls one of the best minds in marketing, and The Economist calls off-putting to some.
Hey ho, let's go.
Hey ho. Yeah, so in the meantime, category design. And you and I have been jamming. Tuning up the guitars. And plus you've been doing, you did the category contenders research and all that, and it kind of continues to evolve. So as it relates to category design, Dr. Ramadan, what's on your mind today?
Well, I think we should talk and celebrate these category contenders.
Yeah.
You know, we did some amazing work back in 2014 on category kings, as we called it at the time. I guess the more PC way of saying that would be category champions today, Christopher.
Look, there are women and men. We can talk about if there's others, but they're definitely women and men. Yep. So I think category queen and category king are
good enough.
Still
good
with that. Appropriate, and it doesn't mean anything against anybody else for that matter. And if you want to be a, what would you call them? A category them?
Yes.
Or maybe just a category winner. Person, category winner.
Champion, something like that.
Yeah, okay, sort of whatever you want.
Those folks.
Yes, the people who earn 76% of the economics in every tech category.
Yeah, that was the...
And actually, hold on, before we jump, so it's been 7-8 years since Play Bigger came out? And it amazes me to this day, Al, that people, when they hear that one company in tech category after tech category earns 2/3 of the economics... And then you guys redid the research, what, a year or two ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
And the number was what?
About the same.
Right. So it looks a lot like a law of physics that's emerged, which is essentially as a new category begins to develop and takes hold, ultimately, one company gets 2/3 of the value. And yet, over and over and over again, we still hear it. Oh, this is going to be a giant space. We just want our own partner. Oh, that's not true. This tech isn't winner take all. Oh, that's a fact. And so there's like a cognitive dissonance. It's like, okay, well, the data is the data. We presented it to HBR. They went all through it. You can walk anybody who wants to get walked through it. How you got to the numbers. I mean, it's not difficult to explain. You take all the categories. You add the companies in each of those categories, value up, market cap valuation, and you say what percentage goes to the champ, the leader, the queen, the king, ta-da, 2/3, 76%. And yet people go, oh yeah, that's really great, but I don't believe that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's 3/4 is 75%. So 2/3 is 66.
But okay,
that's
well,
okay.
Hey,
it's
listen,
a little more.
Grade 10 math was the hardest 12 years. Don't interrupt me when I'm on a roll.
Anyhow, 3/4 goes to one company is what we found, and that's been consistent for the last decade. So let's just start with that. And the underlying thing there is that there's sort of three phases, right? Remember, we talked about this in the book. We talked about sort of the define phase. This is the phase where there's a whole bunch of companies running around all looking for a similar kind of problem and different kind of solution. And there's sort of like there might be 10, maybe 50 companies kind of in that swarm, right? Then there's the second phase, which is the develop phase, which is where a few of those companies kind of really start to win the mindshare of the customers, the problem that they're solving, and it really resonates with people. And then ultimately, to our point, in the dominate phase, one company takes 75%, 76%. And so that—
And our research shows that takes 6 to 10 years normally.
Yeah, the whole— the 6 to 10 is the middle section, which is the really exciting develop section. But the overall thing for an enterprise company is probably more like 15 years, right?
Yeah.
So 5 years in define, 5 years in the middle, and then 5 years in the dominate phase.
Yeah, and sort of plus or minus 6 to 10 years to get to the epic category. When does the epic category battle? So the new opportunity emerges, somebody defines a new problem, somebody redefines an old problem. Somebody suggests a new approach, a new way of thinking, a new technology, a new feature set, a new architecture, a new platform, da-da-da-da-da. That begins to get traction with customers. That attracts new competitors. That attracts more investment. And we start from define and define as the early stage. And if you think about the bell curve, it goes up from there. And then roughly what? How many years in before
the battle royale sort of ends up being sort of like 6 or 7 years into the sort of the game, right? Sometimes in a consumer situation, it might be 3 or 4 years or something like that. And sometimes in a really heavy enterprise, highly regulated, it might be 8 or 10 years. But reality is most for enterprise tech companies, it's in that sort of 6 to 7 year. And it happens quick.
Well, and the interesting thing is if you look with some perspective, you know, there are these interesting outliers, right? So OpenAI, it's over, you could argue, in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Google just recently rebranded Bard to Gemini. And when somebody is rebranding in the middle of a category battle, you know they've lost. So that one was like over almost before it began. And then interestingly enough, most people are in the tech industry don't realize that it was several quarters ago, maybe even more than a year ago, Salesforce surpassed SAP as the number one company in application software licenses, regardless of category, to the enterprise, right? And so, you know, sometimes it's over the minute it begins, OpenAI versus Google, and sometimes Salesforce builds the cloud, and then ultimately, you know, what we're probably 25 plus years into Salesforce's life right now. And not only do they dominate their original category, CRM, now they just dominate the whole thing.
Yeah, expanded the scope of the category now to include a whole bunch of stuff. And by the way, they were talking AI in Salesforce well before OpenAI and all those guys. And so it sort of explains also that whilst sort of generative AI, that actual category sort of showed up in the last, you know, few years, the reality is, you know, knowledge-based systems and everything were back in the 80s when I was writing code. Right. So these categories kind of evolve on each other over time.
Well, there was a point in time in the late 80s, early 90s where, quote unquote, knowledge management software was really hot. Well, we can make a compelling argument that's a precursor to AI, right?
Totally.
The thing I find also interesting is, A, people don't understand that it is winner take all, 76%. And B, they also don't understand as the new category moves from the develop stage, from the design and then to develop stage and then ultimately growth and dominance, there is an epic battle that takes place.
Right.
And it's generally really fast.
It happens quick.
18 to 36 months is what the data shows us on average.
Yeah.
Forget the outliers for a second. And so the thing to me is, I'm always reminded of, you know how much I love boxing and martial arts and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And one of my early heroes, Sugar Ray Leonard. You know, because I was a kid in Montreal when the Olympics were in Montreal in 76, and that was the year he won the gold medal. And he always had a style and a flair.
He was fantastic.
And he still is. You know, Kerry met him. We have incredible photos of Kerry and Sugar Ray Leonard, kissing her. And there's one photo of the two of them squaring off like two fighters.
I want to see that.
And it's priceless. And she had hired him for a corporate event, and totally classy guy. Anyway, long story longer, he has this great quote where he says, people play golf. They don't play boxing. Right. And you know, people play marketing. people play build a product. You don't play category design. One company wins it all and the others fight for 24%. And yeah. So there's a level of criticality in, let's just call it, the game of the tech business that is widely not understood.
Right, right, right. And this whole thing is you have to go into this category, the battle royale, sort of with a winner's mindset. You got to go in there setting the agenda. You have to, you know, I'm not a fighter, but I know enough to know that the guy who's sort of like setting the whole fight up knows what's going to happen as opposed to the dude that's kind of swinging and hoping, right?
So can I tell you about a conversation I had yesterday? This is an entrepreneur I know and love, kind of helping a little bit. She's incredible. And she's in that 18 to 36 months window. And there's, I don't know, roughly 10 or 12 competitors. Mm-hmm. And she's the leader. There's a couple others that have sort of taken, and this is often the case, right? Where there's an overall broad category design and direction, but because the category is new, they've picked sort of very tight niches in it. And then they all start to coalesce around a more broad, quote unquote, right. platform play in this kind of example. And she sent me this text. We ended up talking yesterday and she said, hey, look at all these competitors. She's, would you mind taking a look at their website? So I take a look at their website. They are literally saying exactly the same fucking thing. And she has a different point of view. She's framing the problem in a different way. She's talking about what end user customers want, need, their problems, their opportunities. All the others are talking about, surprise, surprise, their feature set. Right. And they're all saying, oh, we're the all-in-one singing dancing bear. And they're like, oh, we're the all-in-one singing dancing bear. No, and our bear has green things and our bear has blue things. And just like that, right? That's the whole conversation that the competition's having. Yep. And she's over there going, it ain't about bears.
Right.
And so she texted me, sent me all this. And then when we talked, she said, look, we're the only ones not doing this. We're doing this. We have this different point of view and we really think it's right and it's resonating and it's getting traction and we have the data to prove it because we have the usage data around our platform, all this stuff. Like she's highly convicted. However, when 8 or 10 or 12, whatever it is, competitors have all coalesced around the same problem and the same solution, the same feature set, and also the same point of view and languaging to go around it, she's like, I kind of feel like, am I crazy? Because I'm out here by myself.
Right.
And in the conversation, you can imagine what I did. And what I did is say, look, you are doing exactly the breakaway strategy. Because when that 18 to 36 month battle happens, which is exactly where she is, mm-hmm. there are some companies that focus on competition.
Most of them. Most of them focus on competition. Most of them are doing a feature comparison. Most are talking about themselves. Most are doing branding. Most are doing positioning. The reality is it's just an incremental strategy. That's what that is all about, right? And the unfortunate piece of that is that those folks are fighting for 24% of the market cap. That's the bottom line. And if you think about what is it that this used to call it the seminal battle, I think is what you used to call it. We play big and now call it the battle royale. And it's for mindshare, dude, in the minds of the customers. And you taught me long time ago that if you can empathize with a customer's problem, they automatically assume you have the answer, right? And so what's happening with in this battle royale that we see all the time now, which is what you just described with your customer, is that a few of, say there's 10 of these of companies who have a similar solution, a few of them, two or three of them, actually speak to the problem and actually capture the mindshare advantage, right? The problem mindshare advantage is what we call it. And in the end, someone has to buy your shit. Right? It's not about whether I've got 27 features and you've got 25. It's, do they understand my problem? And can they solve it? That's the bottom line. That's the core of that battle, is the problem mindshare battle. And when you win that battle, the rest is over. It's not it doesn't matter whether you've got a V8, a V6, or a V47, right? It's over.
And so this is the conversation I had with her. And we've seen it a billion times. We get the pattern recognition, but people can't see it hiding in plain sight.
Right.
And what I shared with her is, for the bad guys in her category, the emphasis is on the wrong syllable.
Mm-hmm.
They're focused on each other.
Mm-hmm.
They're focused on outdoing each other with a feature set.
Right.
They don't understand category kings own the problem,
right.
Own the category.
Right.
Category kings define the problem slash opportunity, become the solution.
Right.
In their case, they're arguing over who's the solution.
Right.
And she's out here going, the thing that they're doing over here and telling you all about the solution, it's got nothing to do with the real problem you have.
Right.
And she has named, framed, and claimed the problem. And she's marketing the fucking category, the problem, with the customer at the center of it. What does the customer want?
Or need.
Yes.
What are their pain points? What's truly keeping them up at night?
But no, let's talk about our features.
Yeah, right.
Particularly, you know.
And let's position each other against each other in the 27 different dimensions. It's like, it's so silly.
Here's how you know an enterprise software company's fucked. On their homepage is the Gartner chart.
Yeah.
Oh, we just got named leader by Gartner. Oh, and here are all the 15 companies we compete against.
Right.
What?
And the funny thing about all those Gartner reports, same with most of the other analysts, is when they start... They start talking about sort of like, well, this is the customer, this is the experience that, or the problem that the enterprise is trying to solve. It's usually like a sentence. And then there's 27 pages on the solution. That's the problem right there. They don't truly understand what problem they're trying to solve. And in the end, the category king or the category queen is the one who frames the entire scope of the problem and who has the problem and what the consequences costs. The timelines, the emotional costs associated with that problem are. That's what wins the category battle.
And everybody wants to have a product feature conversation, technology conversation. My favorite example of this is Gartner back in the early days of CRM.
Right.
Gartner thought they were the ones who created categories, and they've convinced a lot of people that that's what they do, when in point of fact, they do nothing of the sort. Most people don't remember, in the very beginning, Gartner called CRM, you ready? Term, technology-enabled relationship management.
Okay.
Now look at what the category called the category. Customer relationship management. Okay, that speaks to a customer opportunity or problem. Don't you want to manage your customer relationships more effectively and profitably?
Seems to be.
Well, Gartner... puts, what's the, so look at the two, you know, in category design, listen to the words.
Right.
The first word is technology.
Enabled.
Relationship management. Right. What's more important? The thing that comes first.
Right.
Customer relations. Ta-da. Categories are about customers, their opportunities, their problems. Solutions and technologies are about us. But that was, I'm telling a story that's fucking 30 years old.
Right.
And it's happening again and again and again.
Right. And I also think, Chris, Christopher. I think there's...
Okay, Alan.
a lot of emphasis on sort of the category name. I was reading a bunch of stuff the other day about this, and everyone's arguing about how important the category name is and all that sort of stuff. And on a scale of 1 to 10, I think the category name's at 2. On the scale of 1 to 10... the problem scope and who has it is a 10. And this is what happens is when you get into these product marketing led often sort of arguments, they're worried about exactly the words associated with sort of the category name. The category name is going to come out of the problem, right? So spend all your time there. And that I think is where things have gone sideways, honestly, in the last sort of few decades here, as we've got further and further into technology. So it's, technology is the panacea and the solution is the panacea. And a lot of entrepreneurs we meet, we probably meet 120, 130 a year, 60 or 70 of them get discounted from our point of view immediately because they've got a solution looking for a problem. That's not going to work.
Well, and even worse, they think they're going to win with the solution.
Yeah, better product wins, faster product wins, cheaper. But like, yeah, sure. In a commodity situation, in the dominate phase, that's true. But in the define phase, that is not true.
Remember
at
when
all.
Google launched Google Plus, and it was their Facebook killer, and it was a much better product. Yep. We love Google Plus today, don't we? Mm. I was just messaging you on Google Plus.
That's a great example. I mean, literally, I remember when I first saw Google Plus, it was all, the photos and some of the other features of that off the charts good,
gorgeous,
like spectacular. You know, the problem was the problem that I solved, which was being connected to my network, had already been solved 7 years ago.
Ooh,
kind of a problem. Missed the battle. Oops, adoption's already happened, and like the switching cost was so high. So they
do it over and over again.
Totally.
They launched several years back now this thing to compete against Apple called Google Podcasts.
Looked a lot like the Apple Podcast Player. You could argue it was quote unquote better, prettier, better UX, whatever you want. And I got a thing in my inbox a couple of weeks back that says, we're sunsetting Google Podcasts.
Disconnected.
Because unless you change the problem, you're not going to win solving a problem defined by somebody else.
That's already been solved.
And yet this is like, what? This is, I can't believe it's fucking 2024 and we're still, Google has lost billions of dollars and now they're doing exactly the same with Gemini.
So this is why, Christopher, we're focused on this category contenders, right? So we back to where we started, which is like in the early days, we started with the research around category kings and category queens. We found that 76% of the market cap went to those winners, right? And that's generally as they approach into the dominate phase, that's where they are, right? But you got to wind the clock back 5, 7, maybe even 10 years in some cases and have a look, well, who was contending to be the champion? That's what we call the category contenders. And that's the research that we've done. And honestly, that's where we spend most of our time now, focused on the category contenders.
So if I'm somebody thinking about my own career and I go, okay, I understand one company takes 2/3 of the economics. I understand that as a new category emerges, there are all these contenders now vying for that. I understand there's an 18 to 36 month battle. I'm a potential employee, executive. I'm a potential investor. How do I tell, A, the categories that are interesting, B, who the contenders are, and C, pick the right contender who's going to become the champ?
Yeah, that's why there are these things called investors. That's their job, right, is to think about it. And you got to wind it back to first principles. And so the first principles are that categories themselves are containers in our minds. That's the way we organize our thinking. And the, sort of the analogy that you and I use all the time is like, okay, if you go into a supermarket and you're looking for something for dinner and it, you might go into the frozen foods aisle and then pick out frozen pizza. What we just did there was super category.
Do we really have to have frozen pizza, Al?
Not really. But major category is frozen foods. Subcategory is frozen pizza in that particular case, right? So, and that's the way.
And then DiGiorno's is a brand.
Right.
And the thing that most people don't get is you have to think frozen pizza for dinner is a good idea before you care about whether it's DiGiorno or I don't know who, though.
Right. Exactly. What problem you're solving. And so same thing as it turns out with investors. So if you're an investment manager or you're somebody who takes other people's money, the first question that you get asked is, well, what categories do you invest in? And they would often say something like, well, this department invests in large cap stocks. This department, you know, invests in sort of value stocks. This department invests in technology, growth stocks, and so on and so forth.
Emerging markets.
Right.
S&P, spider fund.
Blah,
these are all
blah,
different
blah.
Categories of investments.
Of investments, right? And so that's how the conversation starts. And then you get into a conversation, say, look, we'd like to go into a growth investor in technology. Okay, stepping down through the category hierarchy.
And when you say that, at first that to somebody not in the industry, it might not sounded like you communicated very much.
Right.
But within the industry, growth stage investing is dramatically different than angel stage or pre-stage
value.
These are all things that indicate the kinds of companies we're looking at. or said a different way, companies that meet certain criteria are called growth, value, early stage, right, whatever. Right. And there's common definitions, that is to say category designs,
right,
of what's
each
a growth
one
stock.
Of those. That's exactly right. And so you and I were looking this morning at the Wall Street Journal Category Kings 10 Realms document that we were just thrilled to see that was published last year. And it was exactly that. It was like going into the supermarket and here you are, here's the major thing. It's like, okay, these are the 10 realms that you need to be aware of as an investor. And then within each realm, there was a whole bunch of companies that were ranked on performance and growth and risks and all sorts of other things, right? So the point being is our brains are just wired that way. We have to think through this top-down lens of like, okay, I've got some money to invest. My problem is I need to have certain returns. Okay, so what categories of investments are going to deliver the returns that I need? You also have a risk profile, and those things are usually, you know, at odds with each other in some ways, or the risk return is the magic that you got to figure out. So the point being, to your question on the investors, that's how investors also look at the technology sector. There's a cloud technology, or a SaaS as it used to be called, sort of category. There's an embedded category. There's an on-prem category that's now a dead category, right? There's lots and lots of different categories inside.
Another one that had explosive growth for a long time, the no-code category, right?
Right. And all of these are the super categories. And then once you get into, let's take that no-code category. We were working with a company called Airtable, incredible company. And they were very much in that. They were workflow enablement and orchestration, right? And so your job is as you're starting from an investor's point of view, you're then starting to whittle down to say, okay, well, who does actually have you believe that the problem is in this particular case, you were just using your no-code example, is that there's only a certain number of programmers in the world. And they can only output certain amount of, you know, capability. So why can't we empower people who aren't programmers to, quote, create workflows and to create and orchestrate the way that things happen in business? And the answer is you can. You just need a, quote, no-code solution to do that, right? Okay, so that's a classic case of somebody who believes in the transition from programmer-led to edge of business led, or the edge of the enterprise led, right? The people who are actually out there want to do it themselves, as opposed to have to come back to headquarters and say, hey, here's my MRD and PRD and FART and every other D, right? So that's how it works.
Just like in the old days, if you wanted to take beautiful photos, maybe you either had to have a super high-end camera and learn yourself, or hire a photographer.
Right.
And now we can be our own Ansel Adams.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. So the problem, from the investor lens, it's I believe in this thesis that we're going to go from programmers to the edge of the enterprise. So who are the companies that fit within that? And so as we talk about this, you can see what happens is at the final stage of this, we're going to go to either company or product conversation to say, okay, how does this company's product meet that need? Explain to me how, in the case of Airtable, just as an example, how their technology actually enables the folks at the edge of the enterprise to do this work. And do I believe I'm seeing customer traction from that particular people at the edge of the enterprise, and what's the value that they're delivering, right? So you're so far down the path at that point, from an investor's lens I'm talking about, that companies are almost the last things you're looking at. Companies and products are the last things you're looking at. And the scary part of all of that is that most people come the other way. They come from product, best product wins, more features are better. Customers, yeah, I think I know what they might want, but I don't really. That's scary.
And it perpetuates. And look, we're not the first people to say this. Far from it. And to me, one of the most powerful expressions of this thinking comes from the godfather of venture capital investing himself, Don Valentine, right, founder of Sequoia. Right. There is a now very famous YouTube video out there. If I'm not mistaken, he's speaking at Stanford. And the whole speech is centered around the premise, the point of view, the category design, the what makes you different that he saw around the founding of Sequoia, and what makes him different. And these are, I'll sort of paraphrase, but he says, we don't invest in people. He said, most VCs talk about, oh, we invest in the people. Da, 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 da. We don't invest in technology. Most VCs talk about da, 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 da. We invest in markets.
Right.
Tell me about the market. Tell me about how the market's going to grow. Tell me about the adjacent markets. Tell me about the competitive landscape today. Tell me what makes you different. Tell me how you're going to win this new market. He fucking says it.
Right.
He's the founder of Sequoia.
He created a category called venture capital
in the tech industry.
That guy.
He and a couple others, but I mean, we all owe Don much. And yet, he's the Yoda. He's our Warren Buffett, our Charlie Munger. And yet here we are, multiple generations of entrepreneurs next, and the best product, best technology wins ethos is stronger today than ever before.
So, category contenders and what we look for. First of all, we've worked with, and you were very much part of this, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of these contenders. And when you first meet with them or their investors, and we do like to meet with their investors, you know, we say to them, like, what are the challenges that you're facing right now? And we'll hear things like, nobody sees my full potential, or I'm being put in the wrong magic quadrant, or we can't connect to C-level executives, or our customers don't understand our roadmap, or there's lack of clarity on direction and goals within the organization, or potential investors just don't see my vision. And they're all real things, and we call those the contender pain points. And a lot of the listeners, Christopher, right now are probably feeling all of those things, right?
Nobody listens to this bullshit.
They're probably feeling these things right now. But the reality is, to your point about Sequoia, is they're symptoms of a much bigger problem. And it's a problem that's actually hiding in plain sight. And it's called market myopia. It's this idea that there's this short-sightedness on the real opportunity. And people are hypnotized by the quest for being better and are suffering from this sort of competitive mindset. And so that brings us always, as we come into the battle royale, to a decision that you have to make. This is perhaps the most important decision that your company has to make, which is compete in someone else's category or create your own. That's the decision you're going to make as you're coming into this thing. And so the gal you were talking about the other day, she was feeling that pain. She was like feeling the pain of being there by herself.
And it's funny that she was absolutely feeling the pain. And she said to me, can you do me a favor as we go forward? Can you make sure I stick to my resolve? She said, because it can make you feel insane when, you know, 10, 12, whatever it is, I forget how many, but like a reasonable number of well-funded venture-backed companies are all having the same product feature conversation, and she's out there having a customer problem opportunity conversation. You can almost feel like the whole marketplace you're in is gaslighting you.
Right.
And she's like, I'm alone, and am I crazy?
Right.
Because I believe this. I know this to be true. I have data that tells me.
Right.
But yet, I'm the only one.
Right. And so it's this question of the two doors. I'm going to go into the create door. I'm going to go into the compete door. And here's the reality, Christopher, and you and I know this well, which is that most founders and investors choose to compete in someone else's category. Why? Well, that's simple. It's easier. It's less risky. The work can be done within one or two departments, as opposed to having to be across companies.
What we need to do, Al, is we need to upgrade our positioning and messaging. Maybe we need a new brand.
Well, yeah, and these companies talk about themselves and their solution. They do branding exercises, positioning exercises, feature comparisons. They explain to the world why they have a better mousetrap.
right? They try to improve their product management approaches so that they can build better PDRs and MIRs and IRAs and DOGs and CATs.
But here, Christopher, is the ugly truth. It's incremental thinking masquerading as exponential fanfare, right? It's people who think they're truly making a difference when in reality it's not. And ultimately, these companies are relegated to compete for just 24% of the market cap. End of story.
The other thing that makes it worse is it's a decision most people don't know they even made.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people say startup, when people say new market, when people say category, when people say marketing, the unchallenged, undiscussed, unconsidered, not thought about, not dialogued, giant fuck assumption is what we're doing here is we're going to create a better, faster, cheaper product service. We're going to launch that. We're going to go to market. We're not going to make the market come to us. No, no, we're going to go to the existing market,
right,
evangelize why we're better. And what we really need is a demo on our homepage that shows why we're better against our competition. We have 16 megaflips and they only have 15. And we're going to win once everybody knows we have 15 megaflips.
Right.
And you know what it always reminds me of? It's so funny how life works. So you remember the old movie, Something About Mary? We've talked about this, right?
Yeah.
And the hitchhiker with the 7-minute abs. You remember this story?
Yes.
You know, so Stiller says, how are you going to make it in life? And he says, you know, the infomercial 8-minute abs, I'm going to do 7-minute abs. Then Stiller goes, well, what happens when somebody comes out with 6-minute abs? Well, it turns out I am now friends with, yeah, I'm going to do 4-minute abs. And what I'm looking for, actually, what I need is 0-minute abs. Yeah. I need bring me a beer abs. But ironically, I have now become friends with Carl Daikeler, the founder and chairman, the company's today called Body. It was originally called Beachbody. And 8-minute abs was his first big breakthrough product.
That's amazing.
And just this is a total random side note. I had him on the podcast. And what he said was, when the movie came out, nobody called him or the company. And he went to see it in the theater with his wife. And he's sitting there in the fucking theater. And the scene comes up. He's like, what? Anyway, I love the story. It sets the whole thing up beautifully. And I think it's hysterical that now the inventor of 8-minute abs and I are buddies.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, basically everybody's got a 7-minute ab strategy.
So then let's talk about the competitors who choose creation sort of over competition, right? They do something entirely different. You were talking about it with the gal you were talking to. And the reality is they define an entirely new container. It's another one. It's the 11 in the Wall Street Journal realms. It's the 11th realm, right?
The other thing I find interesting about this is small E entrepreneurs are intuitive about this, and S&P 500 CEOs can't figure this out.
No, it's tough.
And one of my favorite examples around here, and I've taken you there, so you'll know this one. You remember Bookie's Pizza at Santa Ydares? So I think it's two young guys, if I'm not mistaken. They get going during the pandemic as a little pop-up, and they build a customer base, and they have great pizza.
We went there with Kevin.
Yeah, right. Now, the kind of pizza is that thick pizza. And it's typically called Detroit pizza, right? It's like almost focaccia-y.
A classification or a category of
pizza is Detroit pizza. But as the story, if I understand it correctly, goes, when they in the beginning describe what they were making as Detroit-style pizza as a way to distinguish themselves from the 10,000 other pizza joints in town, some people from Detroit sort of said, hey, you know, this isn't authentic and you guys are adding this thing and you're flavoring and whatever. It's not like, quote unquote, authentic. It's their version of it, right? So here's what they did. It's on their homepage today. And it's on, next time we go, I'll show you. It's on the fucking sandwich board outside the place. You ready?
Yeah.
Here's the category design. Inauthentic Detroit pizza. Right, so there's a million pizza joints in town. There's only one place you can get inauthentic Detroit pizza. But yet the CEO of an S&P 500 company can't understand that. And the Bookies guys totally understand it. And that's part of why they're on fire. A, they make great pizza. They have fantastic service. And they have radical differentiation in a category design that they created.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, to give props to the S&P 500 and the CEOs of these major organizations, we've been doing quite a bit of category design work for companies that are now public. And I remember famously Ryan Smith, who I love. He's the CEO of Qualtrics. He once said to us, "You can never do category design on a public company. I'm going to tell you that now and forever." And I remember being shocked by that because I was like, he might be right. Maybe you can't. And I'm going to tell you, you can. And we have. But there's a couple of pieces to it, Christopher. There's the, if you like, there's the category design process, which takes you through identification of the problem, who has the problem, what the solution is, and ultimately what the blueprint for that solution is, and then ultimately building a point of view and then rolling this thing out. That's the whole thing. It's in our book called Play Bigger. It's what we do every day. And there's this need. Christopher's just dropped his microphone, everybody, all over the floor. He's like completely lost.
Good thing that's an expensive piece of equipment.
So I was saying that before Christopher dropped his microphone, that there's two parts to the equation for one of these big companies. Your example of the pizza guys, who I love, that was a great pizza, they were able to basically change overnight. They could go out there and make that change overnight without much drama. For a Fortune 500 company, that's not the case because you need to mobilize a whole organization. And so what we found is change management becomes a really big thing for these large companies. It's one thing for the CEO to say it. It's another thing for every member of the staff to say it and do it. And so as we go into companies now, especially these big ones, we think about, okay, what is it going to take to mobilize, you know, a 5 or 6 or 7,000 person company to be able to do this? And then one final note on this. I've been working, as you know, on a project here in Santa Cruz on changing the way the community thinks about a problem called climate change. Now, that community happens to be 100,000 people, so as big as some of the biggest Fortune 500 companies in the world. And the same thing is true. We got to clearly identifying the threat very early. I'm talking within the first few weeks with some great scientists. But getting the rest of the organization, the population to understand that threat is still taking time. Right. And getting the city and the county and coastal commission and all of the other regulatory bodies here, understanding both the threat as well as the sort of scope of possible solutions, is like a massive undertaking.
Well, and to your credit, as a result of your work with Professor Griggs and others, right, you had an aha around the problem. And the problem was how the change in the weather, particularly swell direction, intensity of storms and the like, was impacting the coastline.
Yeah, that's right.
And what the environmental, social, and economic impacts were going to be, because there was a radical exponential increase in the degradation of the coastline.
Yeah, like shit was falling in the water, like roads and bike paths and surf breaks and, like,
houses.
Important shit, right?
Right. And then that was affecting beaches and ecosystems and all of it. And the interesting thing is most people here, like I think a lot of people, certainly in the Western world, thought all of that was as a result of increase
rising tide, rising sea level rise, and actually, it's not really. It's something completely different, and that's the that right there.
But that's the big Frodo.
Correct.
That's the issue, right? People have to understand. No, it's not that.
Right, it's something.
It's the
else.
Way these storms are behaving,
and the swell direction in particular, and the period, and some of the other energy sort of components of that, combined with how deep the water is in certain parts of the coastline, which allows the swell to propagate closer to shore and smash into the cliffs and bust up the roads and all that stuff. So now,
but you're dealing with an environment where people, quote unquote, know the problem.
Correct.
Well, it turns out
not so much.
And so now you have, just like category designers who move the world from one place to another place in a market category, right, you have to take people's embedded thinking that they all, particularly in a granola-y, West Coast-y, liberal-y, green-y town, that it's like, oh, all that, you think you're an expert on the climate and the impact, and it's actually a very different thing than you think.
Right. That's exactly right. And that's where the category designer gene in me really fired up. It was like everyone was talking about the impacts of climate change. It's like, oh man, that is such a broad topic. It's like, you know, the impact of investing in poor stocks. It's like, it's not really going to help me at all, right? And so you have to get into and understand that problem better than anybody else. And to your point, Dr. Griggs and Storlazzi and all of the other doctors that I was working with got really focused on this. But the point being that that was probably 3 or 4 weeks into a 1.5 year journey so far, that we got clear on the problem and started evangelizing that problem. We wrote a book and we did a whole bunch of other stuff. But to make change in that coastline requires a whole bunch of other parties, right? You can't just go down there and dump some rock over the side. You know, we tried to do that for many years, but you can't.
And in a business perspective, the marketing department can do branding,
right,
can do positioning, can do messaging, can do campaigns, can do advertising.
And they were.
All by itself.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But if you want to do category design, sales, finance, support, it's an enterprise, it's a business strategy. Totally. And to your point on the erosion, we need a 50-year plan that deals with all of it.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between having a myopic, we'll just kind of Band-Aid do this thing over here, which is fairly incremental, which is, oh, a little bit of the seawall is falling. Maybe we'll fix it. Maybe we won't. As opposed to, what's a 50-year plan for how we want the California coast to work, given the problem we now have framed or we now understand that is different than the problem we thought it was. Translation, category design at the community level and ultimately at the state level.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands going to millions of people coming to terms with this problem and then the kinds of solutions. And so one of the things that we did, to your point, Christopher, is we had to create new language around the solution as well, right? So the problem threat, as we call it in this world, is, well, from 240 to 270 degrees. And the solution that we are all circling around now, and actually tonight at 5:30, we're going to be at London Nelson discussing the final sort of rev of the 50-year vision, is to create a natural feature restoration of many of the things that used to exist out there to help protect that place that we love, which in this case is Westcliff. And so, but what I've truly come to understand as a category designer is that the journey to mobilize the entire community, first of all, then the city and all the city staff and all the city departments, the planning department, the public works department, the XYZ, the traffic department and everything else, like mobilizing all of these folks in a lot of cases is more work than just the design work itself. And so it's the combination of these two things. And that comes back to your comment about public companies and big corporations. They can do it, right? They can really do it. And we worked with Cloudflare, which is a phenomenal company. And when we first met with them, we sort of asked what the problem was, as we always do. I think we had like 37 different problems, right? And they're all, as you get to do this stuff often, you realize, oh my gosh, these are all different levels of problems. Some of them are actually ramifications of the other problem. So when you get clear on it, in that particular case, they got an incredible product portfolio, like everything from on the edge kind of servers all the way through to security. Like it's an incredible company. And the leadership is incredible. Michelle Zatlin, actually, from your country, Canada, is a star. And what we got clear is that actually the IT department is going through a crisis of control, in the sense that you can get a credit card and get any kind of SaaS system anywhere, and all of a sudden it's up inside behind the firewall, and like now you've got 1,000 of these applications running, and then Jimmy wants to use it in Brazil, and Sally wants to use it over in the UK, and all of a sudden.
Yeah, they used to call it shadow IT, right? It's like, oh, well, fuck it. I'll just go to this website,
do it myself.
Put in my corporate credit card, and Bob's my uncle, and now all of a sudden some company the CIO never heard of has got all this data about us.
Totally. And so the CSO and the CIO and all of those folks are shitting themselves, and they've lost control, like literally lost control. Thousands of cloud instances.
Documents are flying all over the place, proprietary information. Who the hell knows?
The whole thing. And so that's what got really crisp for the team at Cloudflare was this crisis of control. The ramifications of that are clear, you know, documents in the wrong places, you know, like all that kind of stuff. And then what?
Think of how much of the shit they could sell to the White House just to control documents of former presidents and vice presidents and the like. Sorry, sometimes I can't help myself.
He's done the left-hand turn again. There goes another zebra. And so at the end of the day, we ultimately went through the category design process with them, and they created this new vision where actually you could connect all this stuff together. You could actually get control of this thing, and we ultimately called it the Connectivity Cloud, and it's been an incredibly successful journey for those folks so far. And they are mobilizing through the thousands and thousands of their workforce today.
I don't know why this story's in my head, but it is. It comes from our friend Eddie Yoon. And years ago, he was doing a category design project for Ballpark Franks, the hot dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were, I just double checked. It was Sara Lee. They were owned by Sara Lee, and now Tyson Foods has purchased Sara Lee. Anyway, they were the category leader, but there was lots of competitors. The category itself wasn't growing the way they wanted it to, and the competitors were nibbling. And so both, you know, A, there was a market share concern, and B, there was a market size, market growth concern. So in a radical open the aperture of your mind kind of way of thinking about the category, Eddie did what he always does, which is go dig around the weird data. And he started to talk to customers. Mm-hmm. And he started to ask a question that almost nobody asks, which is, what problem are you really solving?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out, does, you know, all beef, dot, dot, whatever, whatever matter? Sure. But you know what problem hot dogs solve?
Mm-mm.
For the house?
No.
You're typically a mom, maybe a dad. Your teenage boy gets home at 2:30 or 3 o'clock and
fucking
is quote unquote starving. And you were a teenage boy. I was a teenage boy. You have a hollow when you're 16, 15 years old, you literally have a hollow leg, right? Hollow. I mean, you just, well, guess what? In less than 2 minutes, you can feed many high school boys, teenage boys.
There it is.
By putting Ballpark Franks in the fucking microwave, throwing some mustard and ketchup on them, and Bob's your uncle.
And
so it
happy.
Was a fast, cost-effective way to fill the hole in the leg of your teenage boys.
Oh, girls.
Exactly. And so that was the insight.
Yes.
And it changed the category design because the way they then talked about what they do.
It's not about beef or pork or chicken.
It's the fastest way to feed your teenagers in a healthy way. That was their argument, right? And so the emphasis changed to a whole other syllable.
Yeah.
They did that. And of course, two things happened. A, the category grew again.
Right.
And B, they re-smoked the bad guys.
Right.
But to your point, to the Cloudflare discussion, if you're not willing to really go deep, to ask why 5 to 7 times, to go seek out data, to, I know this is a revolutionary concept, go maybe fucking talk to customers, go beyond the obvious and fight to see the non-obvious, you can wake up and go, oh, we're not in a battle for like whose beef is the I don't know whatter.
Right.
We're in a battle for how effectively can you feed teenagers.
Right, right. And that right there is that's the whisper you have to hear. That's what the great founders do. They hear that whisper where others don't, right? And so that's what the fundamental starting point for category design is all about, is can you hear those whispers? And the problem for most of the folks who come in through the we have a better, faster, it's a competitive situation is someone else has already figured out what those whispers are. Now you're just reacting. You're trying to create a product. And you're talking about your new organic, 100% organic lean beef hot dogs, except they take 7 minutes to cook. Guess what? You don't know what the problem was. It was 2 minutes, dude. You're done.
And what people think they need to do is product design.
Right.
Category design, really, in that sense, is problem design.
Correct.
And in the case of Ballpark, or in the case of Cloudflare, right? In the case of Cloudflare, you know way better than me because you guys did the work, but their competitions are having a speed and feed discussion about carbon denulation. Totally. They show up and go, the problem's chaos.
Right.
It's all
lack
all
of control, or the crisis of control is, I think, what we actually called the villain.
Beautiful. And the cause of the crisis of control is clear. Users can just go out. Your employees can just go out and do whatever they want.
It's coming from everywhere.
Who the hell knows now? It's in your network now. And where's your data going? And fucking A, right?
Good luck.
Well, the competition wants to have a nose-picking conversation about speeds and feeds.
Right.
Exactly the same with Ballpark.
Right.
Competition wants to have a nose-picking discussion about quality of whatever the fuck. And they're like, no. It's about how fast can you feed teenagers.
Right.
Different conversation.
Right.
Different category.
Right. And when you get that lens, when you walk into the CIO's office and you say to her, hey, Jane, I have a pretty good feeling you're feeling this lack of control and anxiety around that. And I'm sort of empathizing with it. And you give some examples of how it might show up inside the organization. Jane starts to lean forward like, holy shit, this dude actually knows what my problem is. This guy actually knows my problem. And I haven't even expressed it as well as he's expressing my problem. What do you do? What happens when someone does that to you and you're empathizing with the problem and you truly understand it? What do you do?
You actually have a physical reaction to it, particularly if it's a problem that's been ongoing and you've talked to a lot of people about.
Right.
When you meet that person, your body relaxes. You're right. Like, oh, fuck.
And you automatically assume they have the answer.
Because they're That's telling the you more point. About your problem than you even
right.
know.
You go to a doctor, you say, I've been running a bit, my knee's really sore. And she says, what happens when we move it that way? It's like, not too bad. What happens? Oh, wow, really hurts when I do that. And like, what about when you flex? Whatever. Like 5 questions in, you're already assuming she's going to tell you the answer of what the thing is. And that's the point, right? When you empathize, and the great founders have always empathized with these problems that meet you where you are. And then when that happens, boom, that CIO's like, oh, wait a sec, that's a conversation I can have. If you walk in and say, hey, I got the best survey tool, as Ryan Smith says, the fastest trip to Betty in the basement is to go in and start talking about surveys to the CEO. Right? The CEO goes like, Ryan, I love you. It was a great game of golf we played the other day. But like, dude, go talk to Jimmy in the basement about the surveys and market research. Like,
and in that space, there was SurveyMonkey.
Uh-huh.
There was
Medallia. Your
thank
buddies.
You. Yeah. That's the fucking awesome geniuses there. And they were all having a survey discussion.
Correct.
Fast. As was Qualtrics.
Totally. They were actually, Ryan said to me, I don't know if I've ever said this on air, but Ryan said to me the first day when we're asking about the challenges, he said, you know what really pisses me off? People call me SurveyMonkey on steroids. That's what pisses me off.
That's called losing the comparison game.
Correct. Right? And so then roll the clock forward, 6-9 months by the time we got through all the category design stuff, Ryan didn't go in and talk about surveys. In fact, they did the most incredible thing. They took the word survey off their website on the day of launch. And they go in and they say to the C-level executive, listen, if you're interested in sort of customer experience, do you know you think you're delivering a fantastic experience 80% of the time, right? The CEO is like, yeah, absolutely. You know, 20% off, not too bad. Like the actual answer is 8. That is a gap that you have between the experience that you think you're delivering and the experience that's actually being delivered. Well, what do you think the CEO is doing now? She's leaning forward, looking at you going, oh my God.
How do we solve that problem?
No, that guy knows the truth.
Right.
Oh my God, that is my problem.
Right.
And it's like, okay, so then how do we solve that problem, Ryan? And then he can start talking about XM, experience management. He can talk about, we have this thing called the customer experience application sitting on our fantastic XM platform, which connects you into all your feeds and speeds and data and every other thing. He's got permission to have that conversation at that point. You've already won the battle of the mind share, the problem mind share battle at that point, because he or she now knows that you know the problem better than she does.
And what Ryan does in that moment is reframe the conversation.
Right.
So the conversation that's being had is, how do we do better surveys? To,
I need more market research, blah, blah, blah.
Right. To, are we delivering the experience we say we are delivering?
Correct.
I just had this conversation this morning. You ready for this one? And I know she won't kill me for telling it because she tells things about me on podcasts that she doesn't ask permission for. So
screw it. Let's go.
Yeah, exactly. So Hannah Grady Williams, she's 25 years old, and she's the founder of DeSkills.
Oh, that girl, yeah.
And it, and what DeSkills does is teach young people, typically teenagers, how to become revenue-producing entrepreneurs using modern digital technology, primarily ChatGPT and other AI products, in 10 weeks or less. So in 10 weeks, she can take a teenager, a young adult with no coding experience, no marketing experience, no entrepreneurial experience, or a little, whatever the case may be, but not somebody who's been doing this kind of stuff. Pair them up with a couple of partners, give them a little direction, surprisingly not much. Set them on a course, give them radical agency, and their objective is real simple. You have to build a piece of technology, you have to deliver value to solve a problem for a customer set, and you have to be earning revenue in 10 weeks. Go. So, the conversation this morning was, she calls me and she says, I have this dilemma. And the dilemma goes like this. A buying trigger for us that has emerged is parents and students want to show special awesomeness on college applications to have their child stand out beyond grades and typical things. Historically, they've said, oh, I volunteer at the food bank, or I, you know, whatever it is to try to communicate that they're a good person doing a cool thing or what have you. And part of that is internships. Oh, I interned at the da-da-da firm, or I worked at the whatever the fuck it is, right? That I have some cool
extra outside of experience.
So they hear about DeSkills and they go, wait a minute. If I can show the project, and because they do it all digitally online, it's all available. You can actually show it to somebody in college admissions, what the kid did, right? They built a thing. So they're like, oh, this is a great sort of Scooby snack, cherry on the sundae or whatever for the college application to help my kid stand out.
Right.
And that's now becoming a buying trigger for enrolling the kid in DeSkills. And the dilemma for her is, well, all that's great. We're sort of the opposite of traditional school. Traditional school is not about entrepreneurship. It's not about agency. It's certainly not about AI. Lots of schools banning it. Lots of teachers against it, this and that. And she's like, we're being used to help win in the old system. But the reality is the old system, at least in part, is kind of the machine we're raging against. What should we do here? And my answer to her was nothing. Because if they view it that way, in category design, we talk about damn the demand. That's what the demand is now. So great. And what's going to happen for the parents and absolutely for the students is during the 10 weeks, and what the parents say at the graduation is, oh my God, I don't recognize my child.
Right.
And then there's this aha that's like, well, do I need to go to college or not, if those are the kinds of skills that matter? And so I guess my point in all of that is, in her case, she's trying to find that line to go to where the category is now, intersect with it, and go, yeah, that's all cool, fine. And in this case, be sort of a bit of a covert pirate and then take the, you thought you wanted that, but what you really need is this, and do it by delivering
But she's been really clear on the problem, which is the kids need to learn these skills to hear a problem, go and build a solution, make money from it. And she's, and so long as she stays true to that, all of the ramifications, i.e. when and if products, when and Christopher's messing around with his freaking headset again. He can't help himself. When and if all of these derivative ramifications and opportunities come up, let them go. But stay focused on the problem, yes. solving the problem for the 16-year-old kid who needs to learn these skills.
Yes.
Stay there. Don't go anywhere else.
And the thing that she's done is she's reframed the problem. And so the interesting thing is a lot of people who try to do this digital education stuff attack the education system head on.
Yeah, it's going to be tough.
And just like Ryan didn't shit on surveys.
It just became a small part of a much bigger thing, honestly.
And
it was attached to a real business problem, need, you know, something that was so high on the priority list.
And what he did masterfully, the company overall, of course, is you thought you wanted surveys.
Right.
But what you really need is, yes. right?
Exam.
And so that's the other thing. People are like, you're going to go into a market where there's no, how are you going to do that? Well, one of the ways you can do that is you can sneak up to the as-is market,
right.
have an interaction with them, damn the demand, set a different agenda. And if you're in the Qualtrics example, as Qualtrics starts to do this, SurveyMonkey and Medallia and whoever else are going, what just happened?
Right.
Because all of a sudden, there was demand for surveys, and now there's not.
Right.
And these guys are growing whatever it is, 10x faster, 3x faster, whatever it is than me. And I thought they were our survey competitor.
Right.
And it's like, you remember that old expression, who moved the cheese? You know, who moved the category?
Right. He just got clear about the problem. Ryan just got clear about the problem. You know, the initial problem was because his dad was very academic, clearly an incredible academic, and he was the classic market research professor. It was about creating the most complete survey tool. What Ryan figured out very quickly once we got into the category design was it was exactly that. It was a tool to measure something else. And we even named it. We called it X data, experience data, and that was to be coupled with operational data or O data. So we created this whole new class of data as a part
X's
of this design.
X's and O's, how genius
it's
is that?
Unbelievable. And
yeah. Somebody should give you more money.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually when SAP bought Qualtrics the first time, Bill McDermott went on stage saying that this is the joining of the O data company, which was SAP. We had all this operational data with the X data company. That was Qualtrics, which had all the experience data. And it's the combination of those two things that were actually so powerful to measure not just what happened, but why.
And that thinking and those words were put in Bill's head by Ryan.
Correct.
Bill didn't come to that conclusion.
He did not.
All by himself.
No. We invented that sometime before that.
Category design. And what was the premium? Do you remember when what Bill paid as a premium?
When we first met him, they were at $1 billion.
Market cap wise?
Yeah, yep. Market cap wise. And then Bill paid $8 billion. The IPO was happening. I think it was priced at around 5. So it was probably, what's that? Probably a 30 or 40% premium on the IPO price. Yeah. And then SAP bought them, folded them in. They realized that it was never going to work as a combined entity. They spun them back out again. And by the time they spun out, they were at $27.1 billion. So from...
And the combined market cap of SurveyMonkey and Medallia today would be?
3 or 4 billion.
At best.
Yeah. So there's your 27 versus 3 or 4.
Ah. 76%. One company wins and everyone else gets fucked.
Right. So that's why, back to the whole point, it's really important to figure these category contenders out, because that was a 27x return by finding Qualtrics at that point, category contender, stepping into the ring. In that case, they thought they were in a survey battle. That wasn't truly what was going on. And, you know, 4 years later, it's 27X. Now, if you look at our category kings and queens, Christopher, if you go back to the 39 companies we identified as category kings back in 2014, their average return compound annual interest rate is about 20%. For category kings, it's more like 50. And so the conference, we're going to the Montgomery conference, you know, next week, and we're being invited to talk about category investing. You know, they saw that Wall Street Journal article and the Wall Street Journal, you know, 10 realms of category kings and all that stuff. And So they asked us to come along and talk about this whole idea of investing in category contenders. And it's exactly the conversation we've had here today, which is that if you can get them, if you can find them and help them get across that, you know, sort of the battle royale and put them in a selves in a place where they are and can become that leader, that ends up being the 10 to 100x kind of returns as opposed to the 2 or 3 or 4x returns that you get with, you know, one of these category kings once they've already been through that journey.
And you know the other thing about the data, God bless Eddie Yoon. We published it in Category Pirates 2 years ago, I think. So he went out and he saw the original Play Bigger data and said, okay, well, let me go do this on the S&P 500.
That's right, yeah.
And the net of it, I can walk you through how he gets there, but the net of it is if investors believe the company is a category designer, they are rewarded with 4x more, so market cap, than competitors. So for every revenue, every growth revenue dollar that a company gets, if the company's considered a category designer, they get 4x the market cap,
right,
and they get 1x or 1.5 or 2x if they're also a good growing company, but they're not viewed as a category leader. That's the rough math.
Yeah, I believe it.
And so here's the trick, and this is the part everybody misses. If you want to be successful in the tech business, you can either A, start a category king, B, join a category king, or C, invest in a category king.
Correct. Correct. And the companies that come before them are the category contenders, so go find them. Like, seriously, go find the category contenders to work for.
And so here's the big question. I've said this for years. If I think about people's careers, I saw it happen a bazillion times. Almost everybody, just like marketers get it all backwards and upside down, they think it's about products and solutions and brands and positioning. Or product makers think it's all about features and technologies and architectures and what have you.
They're important. Both those things are important. It's just not the high order bit.
The high order bit's what's the problem.
Right.
So now with careers, what do people focus on? Do I like my boss? What's the salary? What's the title?
Benefits, blah, blah.
Benefits.
Work from home.
Et cetera. All important.
All important.
However,
mm-hmm.
So it's funny how this triangulates with life all the time. I got a text from a dear friend of mine in the last week, and she's been at the company. She's in marketing, senior marketing leader, and she's been at this company for, I don't know, 2 years-ish. And this company's number one competitor has reached out and offered her a bigger title and a bigger salary.
Mm-hmm.
So she tells me this, and I say, okay, great. I said, and it's not a space I know super well, but sort of tangentially, I said, I thought where you're working is the category king. And she said, absolutely. I said, so what's this other company? She said, oh, we're kicking their ass. I said, okay. I said, and you have a bunch of stock where you are now at the category king, right? Right. That stock's gone up a lot, right? Right. You've been able to sell some of that stock and have it benefit your family, right? Right. You like working at the company, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. You generally like your boss and your team. Yeah. So why are we having this conversation? And you could, it was on text, but you could feel the light bulb go on. Right. She's like, oh, I could actually have a bigger title, more cash comp, and technically more stock, but I'm at a company that's fighting for 24%. I'm not at the category king. And she gets it. She knows our work, da-da. And so she says, got it. And she's not even going to interview.
And it's funny how, as employees, we start to think of ourselves as investors, right? That's the big thought.
You're investing your fucking life in the place.
24/7 most of the time.
Right. Most of us spend more time with the people we work with than the time with our families and friends.
Yeah.
And so, and I think this is a big thing, frankly, Al, you're helping investors, but also I think you're helping people in the tech industry to understand this is the other aha. If you do the math really simply, because I need it to be simple. Let's say the average person stays in the average job in tech for 5 years. I think it's less than that. I think it's 3.5 or something, but let's just keep the math early. And let's say to keep the math simple. And let's say
Let's say you get your first real job at 25, again, to keep the math simple. So how many five-year chunks are there between 25 and 65?
This is a
test for
eight.
You. Eight. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So the other aha for people in their careers is you get eight trips to the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to say it's less than 5 years, okay, maybe you get 10 trips to the plate.
Right.
To do something exponential versus incremental.
Right.
To have the joy, because once you've done it.
That's so cool.
There's nothing. I mean, you and I are addicted to it. It's why we're right. still doing it.
Right.
And then economically, of course, you and I are people who grew up from incredibly modest means.
Yes.
Immigrant, hardworking, lower class families.
Ate potatoes for a week kind of families.
Yeah. Lived on peanut butter and, mm-hmm. and mac and cheese.
Vegemite.
No, God. I'd have to be pretty desperate to be living on Vegemite. But I will tell you, we were having a gourmet dinner when we had enough money to slice the hot dogs into the Kraft mac and cheese. And you and I have had lives and careers as a result of being in tech, being entrepreneurs in tech, the life-changing economic outcome, the relationships. And
the joy. The joy of seeing these people do what Ryan and all of these other founders do.
You know, we were part of the build-out of the internet, and you were a huge part of the build-out of mobile. And like we've been a part of these things, and right. we continue now. As we sort of shift from the operator, doer, Luke, Leia phase into right. the more Obi-Wan, and hopefully we'll earn our Yoda stripes, the reward of it, emotionally, psychically, relationship-wise, many of the closest, look, you and I are best friends. We're adopted brothers because of all of it, right?
Right?
And so that's the other part of it, which is you have 8 to 10 trips to the plate
mm-hmm.
to secure the future for your family,
mm-hmm.
to try to do something exponential, to be on a massively winning team that delivers an incredible amount of value.
Right.
And so I guess what it all leads me to is if you think about the 76%, and then you think about you only have 8 to 10 trips to the plate, the at-stakeness, if you will,
yeah.
in our work meaning building the tech companies of the future, is so much greater than most people act like it is.
Right. Right. And it's like if you said, Hey, Christopher, I'm going to chop your net worth, whether it's $1 million or $100 million into 8 pieces and you get 8 bets. That's a terrifying thought. Like that's scary that you're going to land one of those category contenders or a category king or queen. That's tough. And so to your point, if we go in with this investor mindset, which is what I have very much over the last sort of 5 years become clearer and clearer about, is who are we investing? We being Play Bigger. What projects are we going to do and get clearer about what are we looking for in those companies? And we have sort of a criteria of 6 or 7 different things that we look inside of these companies to determine whether or not this is a candidate for category design. We should publish that sometime, Christopher. And so that I'm talking about in the context of if you're an employee and you're looking to go work somewhere and you've got 8 shots, here's a set of criteria that might help you make those choices.
Yes. And here's the amazing thing to me about this. Put it in the investor context for a second. What do most investors do? Well, they look at the financials. What are the things they look for? Revenue growth, margin expansion and growth, EPS earnings growth, and metrics along those lines.
Right.
And there are very well understood, particularly by category, by industry, mm-hmm. what premiums get placed on what levels of revenue, margin, earnings growth. And I'm just using those three as key indicators, mm-hmm. right? So when most people invest, what do they do? They invest in performance. They say, oh, shit. Microsoft has an almost 40-year track record with some bumps along the way of delivering revenue growth and margin growth and earnings growth and cash flow growth. Great. Let's buy Microsoft. Let's buy Apple. Let's buy Google. Let's buy NVIDIA, et cetera. Nothing wrong with that. But that means you're an investor who's investing in current performance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one kind of investor. People who invest in contenders, people who go to work at contenders,
yes, performance matters. Prior performance always important.
Right.
However,
yeah,
they're investing in
potential.
Potential. Not what is true and is likely to be true. They're asking what could be true.
Right, right, right. And the biggest determinant of understanding category potential is to understand the problem scope and how many people have that problem. And so that is the thing that we look at as our number one screening criteria. So we'll sit down with the CEO or the founder or whatever, and we'll say, okay, tell us about the problem you solve and who has it. And then we'll do our own math. That problem is worth this much or costs this much or has this much value. There's this many people who have it. Multiply those two things together, you get some measure of category scope and the category potential, right? That's one of the things, one of our tests. And so when someone comes in and says, I got a faster, you know, sort of carbon ingulator, to use your term, right? I immediately sort of say, okay, what problem you're solving? And those people can't answer the question. It's like, well, we're not going to, how could we invest in you? Because you don't even understand the problem scope yourself. And as a result, the potential. So anyhow.
And the funny thing or the fascinating thing is obviously it works in tech, but it works everywhere. And I got a couple that are in my head right now that are just so fucking good. One of them is I recently did a podcast with Sean Riley. And Sean is the co-founder and CEO of Dude Wipes. And Dude Wipes.
I need some of those.
You do, actually. I got a bunch of them. I'm going to send you home. You of all people.
I know.
You dirty Australian, you. Which, and you know, Canadians are not exactly the cleanest people either. We spend a lot of time in canoes and having Molson poops. So they are, they went on Shark Tank in, I think, 2015, somewhere around there. Mark Cuban invested, and they are in the top five outcomes ever on Shark Tank.
Wow.
And what he told me was last year, they sold 2.4 billion Dude Wipes.
That's a lot of dudes.
I think if I'm remembering right, excuse me if I'm off a little, I think there's 40 employees in the company. Wow. And they did 150 million in revenue.
Wow. That's a great story.
And that's exactly what they did. They were a bunch of buddies who'd just gotten out of college and were kind of getting going in life. And they're sitting around watching football, drinking beer. And they're like, and he says this on the podcast. He says, we're dudes and we like wipes. We like to have clean asses. We don't want shit on our butts, but there's no dude wipes. There's wipes for whatever, but there's no wipes for dudes. And that's the founding insight, which is there are dudes who want their asses clean. And it turns out, and if you think about it honestly for a second, it's true. Toilet paper does a mediocre job, particularly with dudes who have typically nastier asses. So that's on one, you know, extreme. The other one that I just love, I bumped into these guys on the internet. I just kind of fell in love with them. They consumed all of our stuff and they got into it. Grant and Richard, they're in Indiana. And they're the founders and operators of a very small custom motorcycle business.
Mm-hmm.
And the category is lightweight motorcycles.
Hmm.
And the company's called Janus, J-N-U-S. Everything's a custom bike. And if you look at it, it looks like an old school bike you see in a black and white movie, mm-hmm. but with a modern flair to it. It's the opposite, 180 degree of where all the bike industry is. The bike industry is about these new alloys and these new tires and the engine performance and the, now electric and now all this like massive technology. It's very much like our world, like speeds and feeds and they're like, no. It ain't about any of that. And so the category they came up with is lightweight motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the point of view. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
You ride a Janus lightweight motorcycle when you want to go rambling. And rambling is their version, if you remember back in the day, when BMW relaunched the Mini Cooper. They said, you don't drive a Mini Cooper, you go motoring. So rambling is their motoring. Today, their sales have never been high. Oh, and one more thing. So I help them with some of this just kind of for fun over the internet and talking a few times. And they're kind of on this path anyway because they've consumed all the category design stuff. And they're sort of down this path and it's working. This is, I don't know, a year or so ago. They call me and they go, hey, Christopher, what the fuck do we do? I'm going to send you this thing. Some kind of blogger or influencer type guy who's a big deal in the motorcycle industry has done a review, a video review of the Janus motorcycle, and he shits all over it. He fucking hates it. This is dumb. It's expensive. It's got a lawnmower engine. You could build one of these yourself in your backyard with some fucking, a little bit of pipe and some chicken wire. I don't know what he says. I watched the video. He absolutely can't stand anything about it, right? Because mm-hmm. he's one of these crotch rocket lover mm-hmm. type guys. They're like, what do we do? This is like the biggest piece of PR they'd ever gotten. And it was like bad. Destroying them. I said, here's what we do. Put it on the homepage. So they do. And they do a series of marketing around a term they invent called the motorcycle industrial complex. Anyway, they just launched, let me get it for you because it's just too fucking good. They wrote their manifesto because mm-hmm. they're category design students. Mm-hmm. And the manifesto.
Janus, right?
Janus Motorcycles.
Janus Motorcycles. Yeah.
So here's the book. It's called The Rambler's Companion.
That's brilliant.
The Art, Practice, and Enjoyment of Lightweight Motorcycling.
So you know what they did that's brilliant here? In a lot of ways, they created a new category of motorcycling, the sport. It's a little bit like experience design. It's a thing that you do. You may need experience design products to enable you to deliver those experiences, right? It's the same thing they've done here. And that's what the brilliance of the BMW and the Mini was about motoring, right? It changed the context for what it is that you're doing. So in a lot of ways, you could argue the design was around the activity more than it was around the thing. That's probably what you were about to say.
Which is exactly what they've done, because when you do that, you reframe the problem. See, the problem most motorcycle companies are trying to solve is speeds and feeds and features and da-da-da-da-da, right? And coolness and whatever. They're not trying to solve that problem.
Right.
A Janus is the bike that you drive on Sunday
right.
with your loved one, your sweetie on the back.
Right.
Here, I'll just show you what they look like. And you'll get it the minute you see them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Right? That's amazing.
So, and you'll see, look, I mean,
yeah.
right? That is not a crotch rocket.
No, it's not. No.
Right? This is the one I want right here, the Halcyon 450. Yeah, look at that beauty, holy right? Moly. And like, you might not even take that out on the highway.
Right.
I mean, you can, of course.
Just go down Main Street with that thing.
But yeah, this is you know, you with and your sweetie you go out for, look, there's the, here, the two, Halcyon 250 has the two seats on it. And this is where you go out to brunch with your loved one. Right. And so I guess my point is, so many people get stuck in this competitive.
Yeah. The mindset.
These
guys created a new thing, right? Called rambling, right? They didn't go and compete on speeds or weights, even though they call themselves, ironically, the lightweight
motorcycle. There's no denying it's a motorcycle, but.
No, but the truth is that the innovation in the category here, in their particular case, is rambling. I think I put it to you that I think
that is the and
innovation.
What they are arguing
right.
is they had the courage to be category designers. Everybody else in the industry was arguing features.
Compete.
What these guys said is we're going to argue experience.
Right.
We're a different kind of experience that requires a different kind of motorcycle, which is exactly what Ryan did. Yeah. If you're looking for a survey to solve a survey problem, well, that's one thing.
Talk to Betty in the basement.
Right.
Well, so I'll give you an update when we get back from Montgomery Summit. I think it'll be cool.
I'll be curious. You're going to be meeting with many of the top tech investors on planet Earth.
Right. And a lot of the founders, a lot of the really hot founders are going to be there. It's going to be like 350 companies presenting at this conference. It's like the old school
I used to love those conferences, actually. The financial conferences were the ones
cool,
I always
because
loved
to go you to. Get like you get an opportunity for like 10 minutes and that's it. You lose people in that 10 minutes and they're done. So it's going to be fun. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Al. I love you.
Love you too.
That was the legendary Al Ramadan. You can follow everything Al over at LinkedIn. Just search for Al Ramadan. All right, we would like to thank you. Thank you for investing part of your lives with us. Now, don't just sail those same crowded seas. Chart your own course with Category Pirates. Forget battling for scraps in old market territories. It's time to carve out your very own ocean of opportunity. Leave the armada of competitors in your wake. Discover how to dominate by creating your own category. Go to CategoryPirates.com today. Today's information is provided to you solely for informational purposes. This oddcast is the sole property of the Lockhead Oddcast Network. It contains content known to the state of California to cause new categories and radically different futures. Please consult your lawyer, doctor, shaman, mystic, butcher, mechanic, dental hygienist, yoga instructor, and of course, category designer before acting on any of today's information. Warning, the creators of this oddcast may have been consuming libations. Everything is the way that it is because a category designer changed the way it was. Produced and edited by me, Jason DeFilippo. Sarah Knox and Jamie J do technical execution and build Lockhead.com. Show notes by GM Simon. RJ and EX Bobus do our web development. Cedric Biros does our graphic and web design. The thought we'll leave you with comes from Stephen Covey, who said, "I am not a product of my circumstances, I'm a product of my decisions." Until we meet again, stay safe, stay legendary, and follow your different.